This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Here we are with the last of our 10-episode bonus season experiment. Rebecca, we made it to the end.
We did, and I'm sad that it's the last one because these have been a lot of fun.
They have been fun, and we're working on how to continue them into the future. We want to keep doing them. We probably won't do them every week, but we're figuring out a way where we can do the extra episodes and flex these muscles that we've gotten to flex here on an ongoing basis. So stay tuned for that. We're going to be doing the regular Sunday night news shows on a regular cadence until the heat death of the universe. But at some point in the future, we'll bring back some bonus episodes. I guess it would be helpful. What would you like to know from people as we're deciding what to do? Their favorite episodes is one a week. I don't know. What could they tell us that would be helpful? Like, we want to make stuff they like. So I guess just what you liked about it.
Yeah, that, like the favorite formats maybe, because we've done a couple book nerd movie hours. We've done a couple book club clubs. I think we only did the one, Does It Hold Up, when we were reading Interpretive Maladies After 20 Years. But we have a long list of books that we might be able to do that for, revisiting things that have been out for a while. We did the newsy thing with Nobel.
Half-Baked Ideas we did.
We did Half-Baked Ideas. This is more of a, we're calling this Adaptation Nation because it's not like, you know, one book to one movie. We have a bunch of book-related adaptations of things. Yeah, I'm interested in which formats folks liked, what they liked about them, if there are, you know, specific books or adaptations or things that are coming up that are on your radar that you'd like to have an episode about, or other ideas for things that feel like they're in this wheelhouse of sort of crossing over wider culture into literary discussion.
Yeah, other formats and segments that we could do. Mm-hmm. We're trying to keep it between 30 minutes an hour for these is kind of the idea, but we're going to keep doing them. We had a good time. So thank you guys for hanging in there. It looks, just by looking at the numbers, that people like them about as well as they like the regular show, which we didn't know going in if people would like them less, they'd like them more, whatever. So I'll take that result to start, at least.
Me too. I'm really happy with how it's gone. And it's been fun to get to experiment with how we think about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading.
Because in the old days, 9 weeks ago, we would have just noted that these things had premiered. We're doing Adaptation Nation today, so we watched at least one episode of His Dark Materials, which premiered recently on BBC. I think there's two episodes available. There are four episodes of Watchmen, Damon Lindelof's take on Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' The Watchmen, which is on HBO. And then all the episodes are out for Emily Dickinson. No, it's just called Dickinson.
Just Dickinson.
Which premiered or debuted or was released on Apple TV Plus on November 1st. So they're all recent. I guess Watchmen's been out the longest. It's only been a month. And I think we covered the news of all of them in the regular show saying, huh, isn't this interesting? And that's generally where we'd left these things before, unless we'd gotten to the end of something or we'd watched one. We might have mentioned the future. So this is a kind of a follow-up to the kind of news story we would have done in the past.
We would have just had these conversations off the air before, at least about at least many of these things we would have done and talked about and watched and talked about. So it's just been cool to bring them out and get to investigate further the things that we talked about as news and stuff that was happening, but actually find out like what is going on with this Dickinson show, for instance.
So we're going to go in somewhat arbitrary order just to give us a sequence from what we would consider the most faithful to the source material to the most liberty with the source material. And the second two, we might even have a discussion about it, how you parse that, which it's fun. I guess my first question for you, Rebecca, if we hadn't done this show, which, if any of these shows, would have you have watched organically for Rebecca Fun Time?
I would have tried Dickinson because the trailer was such a trip. I would just need to know what was going on there.
Yes.
And I think that I would have made my way to Watchmen, but probably not as it was airing live, it would have, I think that would have been something like, there are enough people in my circle who love the comic or who are really excited about the show. And I've been seeing it bubble up, you know, coming across my dashboard on social, that I think I would have gotten there. But it has the feeling of something that I would have like marathoned all of them over my Christmas break or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I would have been interested in those two organically. Dickinson more urgently probably than Watchmen, just because it looks so bonkers. And his Dark Materials, I would not have paid attention to at all. What about
and
you?
And then which, I'm not entirely sure. I think like you, I was going to do the rubbernecking on Dickinson, at least for one episode. Like it's really as much of a weird, chaotic fever dream as it seemed. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to answer that now because that's what we call saving it for the segment. I'm not sure on his Dark Materials. I think it would have depended on, I know some people in my life that are into this, whether they thought it was good. And then Watchmen's complicated. And I guess maybe I'll talk more about that when we get there. So I'm not sure. I think the only one for sure I would have tried even a second of is Dickinson. I'm kind of off TV in general. I've been reading more movies. That's how movies work. Watching more movies this year as part of a year-long project. So I need the burden of proof to start a TV show is fairly high. Let's then do this other sort of big picture question before we get to the specific series is, what, if any, familiarity with the source material for these three shows did you have?
Let's see. So I read his Dark Materials. Well, no, I read The Golden Compass, just the first book of the series, mm-hmm. when the movie came out, I guess about a decade ago, when they did that adaptation.
Ish.
Whenever,
decade-ish, yeah.
Ish, sometime in the early 2000s. I read that. I didn't have any familiarity with it from childhood, so I also didn't have like that childhood attachment to the story, but I was mm-hmm. curious. So I read the Golden Compass. I watched the movie. I have like no memory of the story or the movie, which does not bode well for
fascinating,
which I think reflects just this is not the type of story that I'm interested in typically. Mm-hmm. So I was reading it. It felt like homework, I think, to read it and just know what was going on in the culture at the time. So it felt like I was coming relatively fresh to the show. I know, I think a moderate amount about Emily Dickinson. I had a few teachers in high school and in college who were particularly interested in her. So I think I'm carrying probably your average English major's worth of like wonky facts about her. Mm-hmm. And then maybe a few other extra things, just, you know, personal interest forward from that. And then Watchmen, I saw the movie when that came out also, you know, in the, I think, late 90s, early 2000s, whenever the Watchmen movie came out, that was, I think, very faithful to the comic book series. And I remember enjoying the movie, but also did not like deeply encode what it was about. It was, that was like just a movie I went to for entertainment.
On my side, I am closer to the source material in all respects, I think. I read His Dark Materials, the whole trilogy, in one of those giant paperbacks on the beach in the Dominican Republic about a decade ago. I have a very distinct reading memory of that. I mean, how could you not?
Oh, yeah, that's nice.
And then Michelle and I both liked the Daniel Craig and Nicole Kidman-led movie version, which apparently was a box office disaster, which is interesting in the context of this. Watchmen I read a long time ago. I've taught Watchmen in a couple of different contexts. My relationship to it has changed over time from isn't this amazing to yeah, it's pretty good to it's overrated to it's a modern classic, much like many modern classics. It has strengths and weaknesses, but it is definitely influential, continues to be influential. Some say the most artistically, literarily influential comic of all time, which is worth unpacking. We could do a whole series of episodes about that. And I think it does bear on what Lindelof is doing with Watchmen. And Emily Dickinson, she's an American poet from the mid-19th century. Had to study her, know a lot about her, have spent a lot of time with the poetry. I think in the case of, I think it's interesting. I think the more you know about the original Watchmen, the more you get out of the TV show Watchmen. Mm. And I think for the other two, the less you get out of it, which is weird, but we can come back to that here in a minute. All right, we're going to start with His Dark Materials, starring mostly people you haven't heard of in the first few. So I did two episodes. I should say that. I did two episodes of His Dark Materials. How many did you do?
Just the first.
Just the first. So it's James McAvoy, plays Lord Asriel. The 1-minute synopsis of this show is, I think, part of the problem with it, which is you cannot do a 1 minute synopsis. It's a version of the world as we know it, set in a time and place that feels like the 1920s, sort of Art Deco-y. Mm-hmm. And there are dirigibles. Airships are a big thing. Like, you know, you would have seen in the 20s, trivia, the spire of the Chrysler Building, which was completed in 1929, was originally intended to have airships tethered to it. Wow. So that's the moment. That's the fork at the sliding doors of where we left the world of His Dark Materials in terms of the timeline as we understand it. It's a world of magic, but it's a little bit different. It's more embedded. So every person has an animal demon that is their companion, that is part of their soul. It can talk. And until you go basically through puberty, it transforms itself into a number of different animals. But once you become a woman or a man, it's a little unclear what that moment is. We get a ritual about it. But at some point, it fixes itself to a particular situation. There is a large religious body that's called the Magisterium, which is a pretty thinly veneered Catholic Church stand-in, I would say. It starts out in Oxford, England, at one of the Oxford colleges, Jordan College, I believe, and Lyra is our main character, who we are told was orphaned at an early age, left in care of the college by Lord Asriel, played by James McAvoy here, grows up in the ivy-covered walls of the college. And then the story picks up in her 12th year when Lord Asriel comes back from the quote-unquote north, having made a discovery that is heretical to the beliefs of the church and threatens the basically epistemological paradigm of the universe in which we're in. And the larger arc of the story is towards figuring out what that mystery is, figuring out what Lyra's part in it all is to play, and the fate of the universe and everything, basically, is what it is. What are your what was your initial impression of the show?
It's fine. Like, that's how I felt about it. It's fine. I love Ruth Wilson, who plays Mrs. Coulter, who shows up near the end of this episode. I've been a faithful watcher of The Affair on Showtime for the last several years, and she's wonderful in that. And I think her face just does a lot of great work. So I'm interested in seeing her. And then I just felt like, okay, it's the story of like a clever, sneaky child who's spying and wants to go on an adventure, and she has a destiny, and there's all these adults conspiring both for her and against her, and the world is very complicated. Like, I think you summed it up perfectly, that it's impossible to do the elevator pitch for this, for this story. It's beautifully produced. I think the pilot episode is trying to do a lot to introduce viewers to the world and to all the sort of, like, not mythology, but just to what exists in this world, right? That everybody has a familiar, and that also there's this thing called dust, and like apparently talking about it is very dangerous for reasons, but we don't know. And children keep disappearing to something called the Gobblers that may or may not be real. Like, there's all this danger, and whether it's real or not, or how real it is unknown. I think that I did myself an accidental disservice watching this one last, because the world of Watchmen and the world of Dickinson are just like super rich and interesting and layered. And this was beautifully produced, but it didn't feel like I was sucked into it nearly as much. I felt like it was fine, but I also, like, I kind of don't trust my reaction here. It feels to me like this is a show that is produced for people who like the books. And also, I think it's aiming for a younger audience. There's a lot of camera time on Lyra, whatever, and on her younger friend, I think his name is George. You see the kids talking and like sort of plotting things between each other. And the way that the acting is a little, not over the top, but the acting is a little exaggerated in some places that made it feel to me like they're playing towards a younger audience, towards younger people watching this and identifying with the characters. And I think it could really work on that angle. Like, there's stakes and it's scary, but there's not real scary stuff or real terror happening yet in this first episode. I feel like I'm just not the viewer for this show.
I had that in my notes. Who is this show for? And there's a couple ways to think about that. Is it for people who love the book? I wonder about this, about adaptations. Is the idea that the people who love the book are going to be your sort of what they call advocates in the wider culture, and they're going to get excited about it, and then it becomes a thing. Because the fact, the numbers has to be that most people watching any of these things that are reasonably popular have no idea what's going on in the book. So in a way, it should be for interesting for people who have never encountered the idea at all. Like, it has to be the case that probably more people have exposure to His Dark Materials after one episode of it on HBO than have read the book entirely. I don't know if that's true, but it's got to be in the same ballpark, in the millions, right? And so what is the work? What's interesting then about an adaptation for which you know it's going to happen? And I think it has to be that the execution is so interesting that even though you know it's going to happen, it's watchable in its own right. And I think you said this is fine, but I wasn't excited about how they were doing it. It was beautiful. It was capable. The CGI of the animal companions was actually fairly outstanding and astounding for a TV show.
Yeah, that's
true. I kind of know where we're going. Like, I know it, like, not to spoil things, but I know what the Miss Kultura's deal is. I know what Lord Asriel's deal is. I know what's going to happen. I know. I just found myself wondering, like, what am I watching this for? And if the execution isn't top notch, there's not a lot for me to stick around for, I don't think.
Yeah, I think that was another thing that led to my feeling that this might be geared towards a younger audience, or if it's not intended for a younger audience, I think that might be the audience that settles on it, that are at that age where you read a story and you become super attached to the world of the book, to those characters, to the way that things play out, and you want to see a very faithful representation of it on screen.
I guess so. Yeah.
Like, that's my, I don't know if they did that on purpose or not, but I think that the viewer for this is like someone who cares about the story from the book, because it's not, I don't think it's interesting enough to just hook someone who doesn't know anything about it to sit down and keep watching the series. Like, I think that if Bob had been sitting with me while I was watching this, as he was sitting with me while I was watching some of the other ones, he would have just like tuned out and picked up his phone 10 minutes in of like, well, why do we care? Like, I don't know anything about this story. This is fine, but it's not compelling.
And you literally can't figure out what's happening if you have it. Like, you have no, like, there's,
it's
again,
a
this
big,
is,
yeah, it's a big info
spoilers
dump of the first
for the
episode.
First couple episodes, but like, you get, you know, the little rip in space-time where you can go between worlds. It's just there and someone just walks through it. Dust is bad. We can't talk about dust. Okay, I don't understand the paradigm of the world anyway, so this thing that is the sort of counterfactual to the world that I'm supposed to not understand is supposed to bother me. Mm-hmm. Like, the stakes are really hard to understand. The only thing you really understand is once one of the kids gets captured, we got to find them. Like, Lyra is captured, or not Lyra's captured, but her friend is captured and she wants to go find him. But then that's a kidnapping drama. And you know me, I'm not about that life right now. I'm not interested in bad things happen to kids. Yeah. I'm just not.
I think one of the things that propels me to keep watching a series or to even keep reading a book series is how many questions do I have that still need to be answered? And the only real question that I had after the first episode was like, what are the gobblers and how real are they? And then I was thinking about Pan, which is Lyra's familiar, and like, oh, right, I need to refresh myself on the significance of Pan, because Pan is a mythological character, and that has to be an intentional selection there. But the other two things that we watched, which I just think His Dark Materials suffers by comparison to Watchmen and Dickinson, but even by itself, I just didn't have a lot of questions. There's not enough that happened in this episode that made me be like, I need to know more about that, or what is this, or like, let's keep going. Like, they don't explain what dust is, but also it's kind of like, I don't care. It's like a bunch of cranky old men in an academy who don't want the truth to come out about something. Like, okay.
Or they do, but they don't. It is very hard to understand. It's very hard to understand. Like, one of the things, if you've watched TV for a while, you like to see characters from other shows pop up. Like, oh, it's that guy. So we see, you know, the headmaster, or, you know, the dean or whatever this college is, what's his character's name in The Wire? Freeman? I think it's Freeman.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he tries to poison James McAvoy, but then he tries to help him. And you're just like, I get that part of what you're seeing is the world through Lyra's eyes, but she understands way more than we do, and it's still not explained to us. And, you know, one of the geniuses, I'll talk about this in a minute, but one of the geniuses of the Harry Potter universe is that Harry and we have the same perspective on the world. So as he encounters the world, we learn about it as he does. So he has the same questions. He learns the same things. so on and so forth. Where this, there is no one in the show that has our level of understanding. Mm-hmm. So no one gets to hear the answers to the questions we have, which becomes kind of confusing. And it is a trope of, well, many kinds of shows, and Watchmen is no exception, is like part of what keeps you going is there are things you don't understand that you want to understand. But yeah. If you have read the trilogy, well, then you just understand you're not understanding, that they just haven't explained it very well yet. And the other thing that I got to think about Harry here, there's a lot of parallels in terms of the structure. But the thing it got me thinking about is, like, of course someone wants to adapt his Dark Materials. They tried the movie. It's a big property. It's a big IP. You know, there's a real chance for this thing to be a monster hit. But then I got to thinking about young adult pitched or young adult genre fantasies that have become successful series. And depending on how you count Harry, it's middle grade that sort of turned into YA. Mm-hmm. The only one that really made it to the end, and even people didn't like the end as a movie, was the Hunger Games trilogy. The graveyard of failed YA fantasy franchises into movies is significant. And there's only one survivor, I think. It's only Harry at this point. So is this just harder than people think it is? And Harry is like the exception that proves the rule.
I think so too. And you also got Twilight in that same...
Yes.
In that same... Right. So what was happening in the world when they first adapted his Dark Materials for a movie was all of those things. Harry Potter was big, The Twilight. Hunger Games was happening, and Twilight was happening. And I think there were a lot of producers in Hollywood casting about for, like, what is another thing like this that we could latch onto and turn into a successful franchise? Mm. And as you said, this was a box office disaster. So I think that's my first question is, like, why did HBO go back to this? Like, why do you go back to this? Well, because you're not remaking something that was beloved the first time that it was adapted.
No. You think you can get it right, I guess, and there's enough Maybe. Interest in it to get it right. I mean, you think of, like, I mean, the crash and burn that was Divergent, Mortal Engines went nowhere, Percy Jackson's mm-hmm. ended after two. Like, there's way more failures than there are successes. And I say Twilight, it is YA and it is fantasy, but I think the thing that got people into that, I could be wrong, is that it's at its heart, it's a romantic story.
Right, it's the romance.
Which is different mm-hmm. than what we're talking about here. And Hunger Games is this dystopia as much as it's... I'm not even sure I'd call Hunger Games the movie versions. I'm not sure those are YA. That's my... I mean, we can argue about genre,
agree.
But mm-hmm. I'm just not sure that even falls in the same thing. Where Lyra's 12. Like, even she's borderline. She's not middle grade. She's not 9. And she's not 16. So even that is just kind of in-betweenness. I'm just not sure. And I agree that the interestingness that happens with Watchmen, especially, of taking a franchise someone knows and then subverting expectations, but the show being interesting in its own right, is kind of the way forward. A faithful adaptation of, let's be honest, a second tier IP. His Dark Materials is a second tier, but mm-hmm. only because Harry, Lord of the Rings, that's first tier. It's not on the same level of those things. But a faithful adaptation of a second tier IP feels like a recipe for disaster to me. That's a recipe for fine. That's what it is. That's what's a recipe for is fine.
Yeah.
Let's do a sponsor and we'll come back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Charming, easygoing, and rich, Xavier Castillo has the world at his fingertips. He also has no interest in taking over his family's empire, but that hasn't stopped women from throwing themselves at him, unless, of course, the woman in question is his publicist. The cool, the intelligent, the ambitious Sloane Kensington, who is a high-powered publicist who's used to dealing with difficult clients, but none infuriate or tempt her more than a certain billionaire heir with his stupid dimples and laid-back attitude. She may be forced to work with him, but she'll never fall for him because he's a client and that's all he'll ever be. Right? Right, girl. Like, we all know. So, just in case you didn't know, author Anna Wong is the best-selling author and book talk viral author of the Twisted Love series, the King of Sin series. Miss Wong, got it going on, okay? Make sure to check out King of Sloth by Anna Wong. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Song of the Silk's Realms by Judy I. Lin. Xu Wei is a talented young musician who was orphaned at a young age. Her sole family is a kindly uncle, but then her uncle is killed, and she is, of course, devastated. With no family and no patron, Xu Wei is facing the possibility of a lifetime of servitude playing the qin. Then one night, she is unexpectedly called to perform for the enigmatic Duke Meng. He surprises Xu Wei further with an irresistible offer. Serve as a musician in residence at his manor for 1 year, and he'll set her free of her indenture. But the Duke's motives become increasingly more sus when he and Xu Wei barely survive an attack by a nightmarish monster. It's like, what? What's going on here? So this book is a sweeping epic romantasy that follows a talented young musician who is swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke. And who doesn't want to be swept away to the celestial realm by an enigmatic young duke? She's living all our dreams, honestly. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Song of the Six Realms by Judy I. Lin for sponsoring this episode.
Okay. Watchmen. Well, you didn't know the graphic novel, so it's hard for you to say, but I think it is next on the fidelity ladder because while the events of the series are not what happens in the graphic novel Watchmen, from what I've seen from the first three episodes is the presupposition of this series is that everything in that book happened and it's 30 years later, kind of like Force Awakens was for Star Wars. Mm. It's 30 years later, all that stuff happened, and there's some ongoing consequence of all those things happening, but it's fundamentally a different story. But the elements, the themes, the symbols, the representations are all jumbled and reconfigured in some way. Lindelof has called this a Watchmen remixed. And I think all I want now for my literary adaptations is remixed after this idea and this execution. This is all I want now.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I love Damon Lindelof. I watched Lost, even though all the way to the end it was, at the end it was disappointing. And I loved The Leftovers. And the second season of The Leftovers was for sure a remix because it was completely off book. And they were just inventing, like further inventing the universe of that story and taking the characters out of where they ended with Tom Parada's novel. And I loved the first episode. I gave myself the pilot of each one of these series to discuss, like, would I keep going? And I basically knew nothing. Like, I did some Googling after the fact to establish for myself that this is right 30 years after whatever happens in the comic book. And I learned about who Rorschach is and did some work there. But that it feels current and of the moment. They weren't trying to tell a story that is set 30 years ago. They're telling a story that's happening right now that takes on current social and political ideas. That's like, it's weird and it's fun to watch. And there are a ton of layers to things. There are all the historical references on top of historical references. There's music. The soundtrack is super interesting. There's also weird stuff that happens with time that probably has to do with this being based on a comic book. But like, you could have just started this show on HBO and been like, this is a new series HBO is doing about, like, here's the elevator pitch for it. And I would have watched it. I don't need to know that this is an adaptation of a comic. I don't need to know that it's a remix of an existing story. Like, just by itself, as like, if I didn't know that the Watchmen comic book existed, I think this can stand by itself as an interesting series. And it's just made richer, probably, as you were saying, by familiarity with the book.
So one of the things that made Watchmen so influential is that the subtext and sometimes the supratext of Watchmen is the idea of the superhero and the superhero comic and the superhero story and the superhero trope. Taking, you know, Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons took characters from the back catalog of DC, made a gritty superhero show about it that was about power, it was about surveillance, it was about truth. And made a really interesting document. You know, it's very much of its time, of the 80s. I think 83 is when Watchmen came out. And it was a revolution in sophistication for the kinds of ideas that were appearing in comic books. And the series Watchmen that we're getting now keeps that as the DNA it wants to continue, the ideas and the feel and the concerns, without keeping the plot and character necessarily front, or not keeping the same plot and character, even though they exist. And the more you know about the comic, you get Easter eggs, and I think you can be a step or two ahead of figuring out where things are going and who is who if you've read the graphic novel or you saw the movie and remembered literally 1 second of it. But other than that, the concerns are extremely fresh. One of the things Watchmen, the comic about, was terrible about was race. And race is front and center. It is the entree and the side dishes in Damon Lindelof's Watchmen. The new story is about, set in Oklahoma, I think in Tulsa. It begins with a scene from a real historical episode of the Tulsa race riots in 1921, as the backdrop for a history of racial violence and tension in the Tulsa into the future. There is technology that does not exist in our world. There's also people with real supernatural powers in this. But it feels like if you said the date was 2019, with those conceits aside, it could feel like 2019.
Totally.
And we get people who are superheroes, at least in dress and attitude, but not power. So Regina mm-hmm. King, who plays Sister Knight, a.k.a.
fantastic.
Angela Abraham, who's fantastic, basically she has like Batman kinds of powers, which means she has tools and she has extraordinary physical abilities, but she's also not a billionaire and she can only sort of do things a very, very, very capable police officer can do. We get Tim Blake Nelson as Looking Glass, who's sort of a mirror of Rorschach, which is the original character that the 7th Cavalry, which is the antagonist of the show, the white supremacist organization that is the antagonist of the series to this point, is he wears a sort of weird mirrored head mask, and his superpower is what, cognitive or behavioral psychology, it seems to me, mm-hmm. psychology of some course. He's not doing anything except using what, you know, kind of psychology or cognitive behavioral psychology on steroids could do. And then after that, it's like Red Scare, who's like a Russian who just likes to beat people up, who's on the side of the cops. But it is, I mean, all of my intellectual wheels were turning from like the mm-hmm. ninth minute here. And yep. I think that's what ultimately is gotten me fascinated in here is the plot is interesting, but the ideas are really interesting. And the way that the original comic is being remixed is really interesting. And I don't know what's going to happen, but even more than what's going to happen, I'm interested in what the show is about. Because even after three mm-hmm. episodes, I'm still not exactly sure what the show is about in a meta sort of way. I mean, race is a topic, but what is it about? It's something else entirely. And I think thrilling at this point.
Those two things that you just said of I don't know what's going to happen and I'm not totally sure what the show is about. Like, I think those are the things that keep me watching something. Mm-hmm. Unless it's so well established what the show is about and I'm then deeply into what the show is about, which I think like Mad Men is a great example of that. Like, you're looking at a particular time, but Mad Men is fundamentally a show about a guy who's not a super great guy and he's not interested in becoming a better guy. This is who he is. And we're seeing his life and then we're seeing him in the context of the world that he lives in and eventually mm-hmm. the characters around him. I don't necessarily need like a change related character arc if it's very clear what this show is about and what it's trying to do. But I find that confusion or uncertainty maybe at the outset of something very pleasing. It's a really enjoyable experience. And I had the same thing of I was like, okay, but why is there an all black performance of Oklahoma mm-hmm. other than that's just a cool idea? And like, I am not a great student of history, so I had to go Google what Little Bighorn was and why that was the code that mm-hmm. was coming up on their beepers and how that's connected to the historic 7th Cavalry, which gave me insight into why like the white supremacists are called the 7th Cavalry here. And then I have, you know, like, what on earth is happening with Jeremy Irons, who is super weird, and why is his butler trying to cut his cake with a horseshoe? Like, what's happening there? Like, I just have many questions. What's happening there? Why are the white supremacists taking watches apart? Like, are the watchmen an actual reference to watches, mm-hmm. or are we just talking about the act of watching something, or maybe it's both? Like, I love that same sort of unsettledness where it feels really rich and really interesting. And knowing Damon Lindelof, we won't get answers to all of the things, but I think it's going to be a fun journey to the what's going to happen, and that they remixed it and made this story about, you know, police violence and race, and like, those are open questions still in society. So is this intended to be ultimately a reimagining of how things could go? Is it intended to be some sort of prediction? Is it a wish for an alternate world? It's, I don't know, super interesting.
Yeah, and as a fan of comic books and of musical theater and the Midwest, yeah. The all-black performance of Oklahoma in the middle of this document was as, I mean, catnip is maybe not strong enough to how interested I was in just teasing out the layers of signification that were happening on this. So the Don Johnson plays the local police chief. He and his wife and Regina King, her husband, are supposed to go with them, but they're not there. And it's a production of all of Oklahoma where all the characters are black. And in this world, you may not know if that's, to the characters in the world, weird or not. It could be that's what it was. Like, mm-hmm. most of the police force in this universe is black. And we get these inverted scenes of a black police officer pulling over someone who's white, who's driving a car, and it's remixing sort of a primal scene of racial violence in our contemporary life mm-hmm. and turning us on his head and looking at it from different directions. So I was like, well, maybe that's just what Oklahoma was. It's just, you know, this is Tulsa. There's a history of race here that maybe in this world, Oklahoma was always an all black cast, but then it was referred to later as Black right. Oklahoma. So even in the context of this TV show, which is a remix of a foundational work in a genre, it's including a remix of a foundational work in a different genre, because Oklahoma is kind of the watchman of musical theater. Like,
yep.
it's weird to say that out loud, but in 1941, what Oklahoma did to the genre of musical theater made it more complicated, made it darker, made it longer, just did a lot of different things that actually became what we have known as story-driven musical theater. Didn't really exist prior to 1941 when Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote Oklahoma, which is its, and it is, Oklahoma itself was based on something else called Green Grow the Lilacs, which was this weird play that ran for 3 months in January of 1933 that was largely a failure, and they changed the ending. So like, Black Oklahoma is a remix of a influential thing that was actually an adaptation of something else. And I was just like, whoa, galaxy brain. I just couldn't handle it. It was happening yeah. at the same time. And Oklahoma also is very bad about race, the original. Mm-hmm. And making it Black Oklahoma is an acknowledgement of the racial blindnesses of that show, and actually more than blindness, some actual, like, you know, hurtful representations of people, especially from the Far East. And just like that kind of layering suggests a complexity and a mind at work, and who knows what's going to pay off, but it rewards investigation. And I guess yeah. that's so interesting for me at this point.
I think so. I mean, you can hear all of your dopamine firing at
yes.
once
yeah.
right now. Right. And I think that, like, that it rewards investigation and is evidence of a mind at work is also a hallmark of Lindelof TV, mm-hmm. that there are always a lot of intentional layers and some mysteries and some stuff that was put together in a very creative and thoughtful way. Like, nothing is an accident here. I went down a Google rabbit hole that also taught me about the similarities, like the in cultural significance of Oklahoma, the musical, and Watchmen as a graphic novel, and how they are both groundbreaking and paradigm shifting within their respective genres. And then also, like, the scene where Don Johnson, where they're all at the dinner party sort of near the end of the show, and
yes.
Don Johnson is singing People Will Say We're in Love to his wife. His character's first name is Judd. The track at the end of the first episode where he has been hung is, like, opens in Oklahoma
spoiler,
musical
but,
with
yeah,
yeah right
we'll
sorry.
Spoil the first episode. That's okay.
Right.
We got to talk about it the first episode.
Yeah, with poor Judd is dead. Mm-hmm. So they've even gone that far that the character names are similar. It's there is so much happening. The episode is
But he's singing the women's part. He's singing the woman's part at dinner, which is just like,
yeah, and
everything you would expect is flipped around a little bit, and you're so uneasy and unsettled. It's exciting.
It's, like,
it's exciting.
Right, right, and it's like, what's happening? Like, you kind of can maybe relate to the idea that a person might get up at a dinner party and start singing a song from a musical. Maybe you have weirdo friends like I do that would do things like that, but it's also just like, it's uncomfortable. Like, what is he about to do? Because this character has some edge to him, and he doesn't look like the kind of, and also he's like snorting coke in the bathroom. So, like, what is he doing here when he jumps up to sing this song? And the episode's title comes from an Oklahoma lyric. It's summer and we're running out of ice. And, like, what does that mean in the world of the Watchmen? Are things at a, and I think we know in this episode, like, tensions are starting to peak. The 7th Cavalry, people have thought, was, like, sort of underground, but it looks like they're coming back and things are building, and yeah. there's a big shootout at the cattle ranch. And, like, okay, it's summer and you're running out of ice. You can't keep the heat controlled anymore. So what's going to happen when it gets really, really hot? There's just so much there. I love a show. I love a book, a work of music where it's just layered and there's so much to unpack. There's just a lot to dissect here.
Yeah. So I think this is the only one I'm going to continue watching, which maybe is a segue into Dickinson. How many Watchmen did you get through? Did you say
I only got through one of each? I got through one of each of these. Yeah.
Yeah, I did three Watchmen. And the third one, this is not a spoiler really, except I know you'll be excited that Jean Smart makes an appearance in a in a main role.
Yeah, I'm in for Watchmen. I'm going to finish the season.
Okay, so let's proceed to Emily Dickinson, but let's do one last sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have seven great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love. But the thing is, she's number six. So if he is to have seven great loves, does that mean his time with Irena is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first-generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
I'm afraid this is where we're going to diverge on Dickinson.
I'm not surprised.
Would you like the pro or the con? Or I mean, to go gonna, first. You're the pro. You would like to go first or second?
I'll go first.
Well, I did the setup for the first two. Give us the synopsis.
Yeah, I'll do the first.
And then give me your take. Yeah.
So I think the quick pitch for this is it's a show about Emily Dickinson as a late teenager set in the 19th century. Yes.
1850-ish.
Yeah. So, set in the mid-19th century, where the world and the characters look period appropriate, but they talk like modern people. And they have, like, sensibilities of 2019, and the show brings in artistic sensibilities of 2019. The soundtrack is modern. So, like, old-timey people and settings, but all of the culture, it feels very current. And then there are also some creative, weird, almost fantasy-esque like elements of how the story is told. But it feels a little like you're on drugs. Like I think I joked when we watched the trailer of like, I'm going to need to get high before I can watch the whole thing. And I feel now having watched it, that like you don't need drugs if you're watching Dickinson because it itself feels like you're on drugs alone.
So when you say like, maybe this is the part that is interesting for people to understand. When you say the cultural feel, it's like they behave.
Yeah.
It's not like if they dropped down Haley Stanfield in 1851 in Amherst, that this is how she behaved, except if you just sort of downloaded her mannerisms and attitude is what you would get.
She's dressed like a 19-year-old in the late 1850s, but she talks like a 19-year-old in 2019. Like, she's sassy at her parents, the way she holds her body and her mannerisms, mm-hmm. and kind of like lounges in this slouchy position across the couch. She's very mouthy, for lack of a better term,
yes.
and sarcastic. There's a great moment where her mother tells her, for some reason, like, "You are not a cat." And she's like, "Oh, tragically, I'm a woman," you know? and it's just... she's very fresh. And the music, there's a lot of hip hop and like some house music that plays. And it, to me, it feels even weirder than the juxtaposition of Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet, which is just a nice thing that we happen to have just watched that.
Right.
But in that case, like, the characters look modern, the soundtrack is modern, everything about that world is modern and strange, and they're just speaking in Shakespearean language. And this is maybe an inversion of that, where the world looks old-fashioned, the characters are dressed old-fashioned, but the language and the soundtrack are brought up to speed.
Yeah, I think that's right. If there is a frisson of pleasure, it's the disjunction between they're out there getting water from the well at 4 a.m. because they need it to start cooking, and we're hashtag millennial talking. And
yeah,
that's kind of funny. I guess I don't get it. Like, I don't understand the point of it is kind of where
I found it.
I'm not sure what's the point. And I don't mean this rhetorically, not that there is no point, but I didn't understand what was productive of clashing sort of an 1851 setting and social normative kind of world and dropping in a Freaky Friday kind of way. Like, what if a millennial woke up tomorrow, didn't know anything about their current state of being, but talked this way? I'm not sure what spark has produced that friction that I'm supposed to understand.
I think this is how you get millennials to care about Emily Dickinson or to care about a poet from the
1850s. Why do I do that then? And then why do I do that?
Right. So Emily Dickinson, like, matters, I think, not just because of the work, but also, like, Emily Dickinson, the person, was subversive. And that story is only really just starting to be told that, like, what I learned in high school was that she was just reclusive. What we know now is that she was queer, and she was having she was in love with her best friend who became engaged to her brother. Like, it's a fascinating story and a fascinating life that wasn't really told. And so, like, and I think if you were to set the whole thing in period piece land with, like, old-fashioned settings and dress and language and try to get a bunch of millennials to care about it, it's just not interesting. Like, then my mom is watching it. You know, my mom is watching the period series about Emily Dickinson. But updating it to be like this is youth culture, and this is something that millennials have been largely responsible for bringing into mainstream culture, is the addressing of queer identities and the sort of looking back into what the untold stories about artists, significant artists from the past, really were, and bringing those, like, no, she wasn't just a recluse, she was gay, and, like, she was kind of miserable because she was a progressive woman at a time when women couldn't be progressive, and she probably did think it was bullshit that she had to get the water and her brother didn't just because he was a boy. But in this show, she actually gets to say it. I just found it so satisfying.
That's interesting. I guess my reaction was more along the lines of Dickinson was subversive. She was strange. She was a challenge to anyone's idea of a woman at the time, but even our idea of a woman now and an artist now and what it means to create art and what it means to create poetry. And I guess I kind of have a similar, I'm not hating on it, but I have, like, a quizzical look on my face, much like when we talked about the water dancer. Like, why make Harriet Tubman magic? Harriet Tubman was awesome by herself. Like, why may Emily Dickinson different? Tell the story and tell it straight, which is weird because Emily Dickinson says tell the truth but tell it slant, which is an Emily Dickinson thing. But in this is, like, the truth of the story presented in a way that's energetic and dynamic seems like enough to me. And it's its own kind of erasure to say, well, what if Emily Dickinson but quirky? I just feel like I don't know what I'm getting. Why are we doing that and not the thing itself? If the thing itself is interesting, then why spin it on its head, do a dog and pony show to get people to pay attention to it? It feels like that's like using a Trojan horse, but then the Trojan horse is full of explosives. It just blows up once it gets in the door because then it's gone and you haven't invaded anything. There's something else going on here that I don't get. I just don't.
I think, I think that the...
And it's me. I'm sure it's me.
The there is there for, like, the feminism is front and center. And they have this, Emily and Sue, her best friend and lover, have this conversation about why Sue has to be engaged to Emily's brother. And it's because her whole family is dead. And if she doesn't get married to someone, she's literally going to starve. And like, they really hang a lantern on where women are situated in this world. Emily's friend wants to publish her poetry, but her father freaks out because what will people think of the family? And he doesn't approve of, you know, women doing those things. So you do get the old-fashioned sensibilities coming in. I feel like I've just watched enough movies set in this time period or old-fashioned kinds of things where girls weren't allowed to do stuff and their fathers held them down and they were subversive that, like, Emily Dickinson's story is significant, but it just wouldn't be, I think it just wouldn't be interesting to, or wouldn't be interesting enough to, like, make a compelling TV series about it. To just tell another one of those stories. And it happens to be that this one is about Emily Dickinson. Like, to me, mixing it up makes it, is what makes it really interesting. And she, it highlights how subversive she was. Like, that, like, there's a rapper playing Death and she's talking about how she's in love with Death and she's obsessed with Death. And I was like, is that Wiz Khalifa? Like, what's, what's happening on screen here that she's doing this? But the way that they also show when ideas come to her, feels weird and cool. And there's a nice little moment at the end of the first episode where she's working on Because I Could Not Stop for Death. And she's like sitting up in the middle of the night writing. And in the last moment of the show, she goes, nailed it. And I was like, I love this. Like, I think we get to see, you can imagine some emotionality to her that was at least totally lacking in the way that I learned about Emily Dickinson.
It's, well, because it wasn't true. I mean, well. I mean, there's, because that's not, I think it's just not for me. And I'm not saying it's bad. It's like Emily Dickinson's real story is fascinating and weird and enough of a mystery that that's enough for me. But that's why I was an English major. And that's why I read a biography of Emily Dickinson. Like, I don't think that's, I don't need this to get on board with it.
Yeah, that's the difference, is like, this show is not for people who have read the 400-page biography of Emily Dickinson.
Yeah. And I guess if, I didn't read anything from any of the creators of these shows before watching it because I didn't want to look at it through those prisms. I'd be super interested to see what Angela something I think is the showrunner behind this one. It's not someone whose work I was familiar with before. Mm-hmm. Like, what does a win look like? Like, is she hoping people discover Emily Dickinson? If people, you know, is this a kind of manic representation of her subversiveness? Like, how do you represent 1851 subversion to something that someone will understand as subversion today? Because writing 1800 poems on scraps of paper and never leaving your room, or almost never leaving your room in 1856 or whatever, was radical in its own way, but it just feels weird and sad now. And it was weird and sad at the time, but I don't think it feels radical now. So how do you visually and artistically represent to people in 2019? How would Emily Dickinson need to feel like to us to represent what it felt like to people in 1866 reading Emily Dickinson poems for the first time? I think that project is super interesting. I'm just not sure it succeeds. Yeah. The transmitter and the radio aren't matching up for
I think that this
particular.
Is, I think at least from the pilot, that the show is not so much about how did other people feel about Emily Dickinson in her world, but what did it feel like to be Emily Dickinson? And that she comes across the way that she does and she speaks in millennial speak makes her relatable to today's audience. Like, you can, if you have recently been a teenager, you can probably look at her and be like, that, yeah, that's how I would be feeling in that moment. How would it feel to be, what does it feel like when you're working on creative ideas? Like, I loved how the moments of inspiration are portrayed on screen, and it felt like a much better version of like horrible attempts that we saw in the Da Vinci Code movie, when you see Robert Langdon trying to like crack codes, like how his thinking is portrayed on screen. You see Dickinson's creative process a little bit here, of like she's just standing somewhere and somebody says a thing and she has the inspiration for like this line and how it has come about. And I felt like we got to dive into how it feels to be her, because she is radical and she is weird and she's fantasizing about getting into a carriage with Death played by Wiz Khalifa, and the music is like very like present and jarring as well. And I think all of that adds up to identifying with her, with how out of place she feels in this world.
Yeah, I had this note at the end. I was like, I think I would really like the show if it wasn't called Dickinson and it wasn't about Emily Dickinson. If Hayley Stanfield was named something else and she was 16 and trying to be a writer in Amherst and the show was exactly the same, like I just, for me, I don't,
you just
the
can't.
poetry isn't at the center of this. Like, and if you're not actually representing what Emily Dickinson's life was and the radicality of it, then I'm not sure what the Dickensian layer or Dickensian, the Dickensian layer is
Dickinsonian?
Dickinsonian layer adds if you're not actually grappling with the art or the reality of it. Like that part, because Hayley Stanfield, I'll watch her do anything. She's awesome. She's an awesome actress. I loved her in Edge of 17. She made the movie Bumblebee almost watchable by herself. It wasn't. But so I'm like, I was in on it. I'm like, I kind of want Stars Hollow 1851. Like I'm kind of in on that. But like the taking this literary history that I know and then cavalier is too strong, but being loose is too weak. To be almost flippant about the history, I don't know, felt weird to me. And also I'd like to know, I think they already renewed it for another season. I have no idea where their season ends, but when Emily Dickinson's a teenager, she's described as, you know, a vibrant girl and she goes to school. It gets dark for her over her life. And I'm fascinated to see whether or not they choose to take up the thread of that truth or not.
That like, really matters.
I just don't know.
Like, if the show runs into that period of her life, it really, really will matter how they address that. And to erase that would be like a travesty on several levels. I feel like
maybe that's what I'm afraid of. I think that, I might be afraid of that.
That I get that. I feel like we've seen that. For me, the first episode landed in terms of it feels radical and weird, and it's telling us about how radical and weird she was. Do you want to talk about other casting at all?
Yeah, I mean, maybe from the three shows, are there any standout performances? Whether you mentioned Mrs. Coulter in
Ruth
His
Wilson.
Dark Mature, Ruth Wilson, who has like a demon frog kind of a face, which is kind of great for this portrayal of Mrs. Coulter, especially if you know where that's going.
Regina King is going to make Watchmen for me, totally.
She has a thing on camera of being competent, and she's short and small and like powerful, but also vulnerable. That's magnetic. She's unbelievable.
I feel Regina King. I've loved her since she played Cuba Gooding Jr.'s wife in Jerry Maguire and was all that same sort of like powerful, competent, but sensitive female character, that woman at the same time that I just love watching her. I find her so compelling and believable. I was glad, I think in Dickinson, I love Toby Huss. And Toby Huss is showing up not speaking in a Southern accent. So like part of my brain was like, Toby Huss is Emily Dickinson's father and he's talking like old school Amherst because he's just always Southern. My only quibble, I think, across any of these three that we watched about casting is I think it's impossible to take Jane Krakowski seriously.
And, I don't think you're supposed to. I think that's her looking like she's barely holding it together is part of the shtick for that character there. Like, she looks like she's about to explode into a murderous rage. And there's something about her face and her energy that if she's not full Jane Krakowski, you realize that the nuclear rod has been pulled out and this thing could melt down. And I actually kind of like that weird tension, that energy she was throwing off there. But it was notable. I definitely agree.
Yeah, it's definitely a weird energy. I'm not sure it was the weird energy I wanted. And it could just be I'm so used to seeing her in like just straight comedy that watching her and I'm waiting for the punchline and I don't think we're going to get a punchline here. It unsettled me. But maybe the unsettledness of it is intentional.
You know, Lyra has a lot of work to do in His Dark Materials. And the young woman is called Daphne Freen or something like that. In the credits, I can't read my own handwriting. I think she's good. There's just a lot of time of watching her think and react to stuff that's so much work to do. It's just a really hard role. And she's not bad. It's just the book, you know, books are different as I know it's going to come as a shock to everybody, but for some reason it doesn't feel as claustrophobic to spend that much time with one character who is also trapped. But the episode feels very claustrophobic and there's a lot of close-up of Lyra looking at stuff. And I'm like, this is tough acting. she doesn't get much chance to react in a human way to other people. She's usually subject to them, besides her one friend who then summarily gets kidnapped. Like, tough look for Lyra and her friends here. McAvoy is doing a, I don't know, I think you headed on something interesting about the adult performances, which they're kind of one note. Like, they each have sort of one trait that they perform, and that's who they are to Lyra, who is our cipher for the whole show. Mm-hmm. It's just a lot to do, and it's a lot of acting by herself, which in a movie, it's just very difficult to do. One of the things, again, to bring it back to Harry Potter, and what it does is, like, he gets Ron and Hermione pretty quick in that. So he has allies and friends and co-conspirators, and Lyra's alone, and even when she's not alone, she has these weird relationships. I just think it's so hard to do. I love to see Tim Blake Nelson. I have my standout categories. I'll watch him again. I don't care what Tim Blake Nelson is doing. He's just weird and interesting every single time. And he's particularly weird and interesting in this one because most of the time his face is covered up and he's really laying into this sort of drawl-like character. And he's a weird-looking guy who's using this head covering to seem more intimidating, I guess. That part was all really interesting. Mm-hmm. I thought it was great. Anything else? So Watchmen, we're both in on.
Yeah.
You're in on Dickinson. We're both out on His Dark Materials.
I think so. Like. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, let us know what you thought. Last words, Rebecca, here.
This was fun. I'm glad we had so many good contenders at once because we have occasionally been like, have we jumped the shark in the land of adaptations?
Yes, that's
so
true.
Many, you know, like, did we peak already? How many more adaptations could there possibly be? But three really interesting ones that all dropped at the same time at the start of the season three potentially really interesting ones. I'm glad that we got to do all of these. And it was fun to watch them in succession and sort of think about how would I choose between these if I were going to just pick one.
None of them was a turkey, really. I mean,
yeah,
His Dark Materials kind of was okay, but...
Yeah, I think I feel like this is just not for me about His Dark Materials in the way that you're sounding like you feel like that about Dickinson. That I'm also starting to think about the winter, like late winter TV time when, I think in February, Little Fires Everywhere will come out on Hulu, and I wonder if there are some other adaptations around the same time that we could do this with. But this was fun. It was a good way to end our bonus episodes.
It was. The only one that we missed that is getting a little buzz, because apparently it's really good, is a miniseries on Hulu adaptation of Looking for Alaska by John Green, which apparently is great, and also I don't think it's as strong as a remix of the book, but it's does something different, and apparently that's really good. So if you're looking for another one out there, you might go try Looking for Alaska, which hits a quadrant. Well, there's more than a quadrant, which is a space we haven't hit here, which is realism. You know, none of these are realist TV shows that we talked about today, and that one is. It's interesting too. I think in a different world in which, and we have lived through this world because we've seen it, His Dark Materials, Watchmen, and Looking for Alaska would be or were all movies. And now, because the way of the world, they're getting a series treatment, which is just interesting. I don't know, like His Dark Materials, I watched the first 2 hours of that, and they're just now sort of getting started. And the Golden Compass did the whole book in 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And in that regard, I'm like, how could the movie have ever been good in that way? Like in Watchmen, for that matter too, like how could the book have ever been anything interesting other than paint by numbers when it's just trying to get through the plot?
The flip of that is, if you can tell the whole story in 2 hours, why do you need a season or four seasons of TV?
Well, that's what I was thinking about Dickinson. Like, if one of these needed to, if I had to pick one of these to be a 2 hour movie, I think maybe I would pick Dickinson to get through it, but also you would see the arc all in one entire, where some of my trepidation was, how are they going to do this? Where am I going to end up? And instead it's what, 8 episodes with another season?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I could have been in on Dickinson as a limited run miniseries, or this is just a one-off 8-episode season that will tell the whole story. Because I do think it's very important that they address her adulthood and how dark and difficult it was. And I have some questions about how long it might take to get there, but it's so weird. They could also play with time in how the series runs. So I'll keep you posted.
Yeah. I guess the bookend on this is we've had a couple of high profile literary adaptations come out in movie theaters this year. Notably the Goldfinch and Motherless Brooklyn, which both, I think the technical term is crap the bed at the box mm-hmm. office. Like the Goldfinch is, my understanding is an all-time box office turkey, like did $4 million in business on an $80 million budget. And Ed Norton's version of Motherless Brooklyn that he's been trying to get made into for a million years, which is a remix of the original. It's set in a different time and it's sort of a different place. So remix is not the pixie dust you can drip on anything. That did like $3.5 million in business in the opening weekend. So I don't, maybe they're just bad. You know, sometimes movies are just bad. They're just bad. But sometimes people don't want to go see something they've already read on screen if there's not a real hook to say that it's going to be an additive experience rather than just a mimetic one, which is interesting. All right, Rebecca, we will talk to you later. And everyone else, thanks so much for listening to these bonus episodes. Shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. Good feedback and, you know, criticisms and praise about what we can do with these extra time together would be really fascinating and helpful for us to hear. Rebecca,
yes, thank you.
We'll talk to you soon, I'm sure, in some capacity.
Have a good one.